You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 29th of September 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan enters a third day. We'll examine how the dispute over the breakaway region of Nagorno-Karabakh has flared up so violently and so quickly. Also coming up, the UK says it won't back down in breaking international law when it comes to Brexit. What happens next in the race for a deal with the EU?
852 people, Finns, Estonians and Swedes, died, and that means a lot of us lost friends and relatives in the accident.
We'll hear about some startling new information about one of the worst maritime disasters in modern history. And we look ahead to the first presidential debate between Joe Biden and Donald Trump.
It's unclear the kind of strategy that Donald Trump will take to try and bat those questions away.
Plus, we celebrate Milan as it brings back together the design world for the first time since lockdown. All that, plus the newspapers and the business news too. That's coming up on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in today's news. The number of people who've died with the coronavirus has passed the 1 million mark worldwide. The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, says Donald Trump's alleged tax avoidance is a matter of national security. And the mayor of a village in Romania has been re-elected to office despite dying 4 weeks ago. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories and others. But first, why has violence flared up so suddenly between Armenia and Azerbaijan? The overall death toll has reportedly risen to 95 following a second day of fighting in the southern Caucasus. At least a dozen soldiers have been killed. The disputed region of Nagorno-Karabakh has been at the heart of a decades-old conflict between the two former Soviet republics, but this is the fiercest fighting for some time. Well, Mary Dajewski is a journalist and former foreign correspondent based in Moscow, Paris and Washington, among other places. Mary, welcome back to Monocle 24.
Thank you.
Could you just bring us up to date a little bit? This is a dispute over a crucial transit route for gas and oil, but we're used to this fight going right back to the 1980s. Could you give us a little bit of a background, please?
Yes, it's a very interesting and very unusual area in that it's quite small. The population is only 150,000 and it sits in Azerbaijan. And that's the jurisdiction, technically. But it's populated almost entirely by ethnic Armenians who govern themselves and have a degree of self-determination. But of course, Azerbaijan doesn't like the idea that they've got an enclave of neighbouring Armenia inside their country. So what this has been about, really, since the end of the 1980s, when the Soviet Union was collapsing, is about Azerbaijan trying to assert its authority over the whole area, but Armenia refusing to give it up and talking about its own rights. It's very difficult to see how you can really solve this, because other than giving Armenia a whole slice of what is currently Azerbaijani territory, or depriving the Armenian population of the self-government that they've currently got, it's very hard to see how this can be solved. Which is one of the reasons it hasn't been solved since there was a war, pretty much an all-out war between Azerbaijan and Armenia, 1988 to pretty much 1994, when a ceasefire was agreed, negotiated by Russia. Since then, it's been uneasily at peace with various flare-ups. There was a flare-up in 1996 and completely out of the blue, really, there was a flare-up too this July. And what we may be looking at now is a sort of logical response, in a way, to the very small flare-up that happened in July. The idea that Azerbaijan was not going to let things rest as they were, that Armenia couldn't stand by while, as it saw it, the rights of Armenians were being violated. So that's what you're looking at now. But it is something that's come pretty much out of the blue, at least to the extent that the violence is as widespread and the weapons are, that they've got heavy weaponry up there, which is something else that hasn't really been used for quite a long time.
Where they've got these weapons from, and indeed, you know, if it just is a simple dispute between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and whether there are other elements involved in this.
Well, one of the new elements this time seems to be that Turkey has taken a much more assertive interest than before. Before, it was very much a bilateral conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. What seems to have happened now is that since the skirmishes, really, in July, that Turkey has moved to back Azerbaijan, and there are reports that it held exercises somewhere in the vicinity, and it left a degree of bits of hardware and weaponry in Azerbaijan that are now being used. And of course, if you look at the wider regional picture, you could say that Turkey's backing for Azerbaijan, if not its immediate involvement, reflects what's seen across the region as a more assertive attitude by Turkey generally.
Some people are saying that actually Turkey's involvement here is actually proving a problem for Moscow, because although Moscow has sought to be neutral in the dispute, it sees these former Soviet states as allies, doesn't it? And it has intervened in the past to mediate. So is this also as much of a sort of a threat to Moscow's influence than anything else?
Yes, it places Moscow in a very difficult position, because Moscow has in the past been the mediator. But Moscow has supplied weapons to both sides, not particularly for this conflict, but as Moscow would say, and those countries would say, for their national security. And Moscow is aligned with both of them on economic matters. Armenia had a sort of mini revolution about 2 years ago, but Moscow stayed friends, you know, unlike, complete contrast to what happened in Ukraine. So Moscow has tried to play both sides, and under normal circumstances would be in a position to mediate. But there are two reasons why this is actually very difficult at the moment. One of them, as you say, is the pretty much overt involvement of Turkey, and the fact that, of course, there is no love lost at all between Turkey and Armenia, probably even less than between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And the other problem is that Russia really doesn't want to damage relations, particularly with Armenia, because Armenia is one of the countries that has given post-Soviet Russia really fewer problems than almost any of its of the former parts of the Soviet Union. It's maintained steady economic relations. It hasn't had any territorial disputes. And Moscow would obviously prefer to keep it that way. But Moscow is also, you know, when you look at what's going on now, Moscow is really otherwise occupied. It's still involved in Syria, though we don't hear very much about that these days. It's got the protests in Belarus on its western border, which of course is nothing to do with Russia particularly, but Russia would see it as an element of its security, and it's watching what's happening in Belarus very carefully. It's had regional protests in the Russian Far East, in Khabarovsk. Things are not really very calm on the Russian front, which means that Russia is really quite distracted rather than having this on its plate as well.
What about the people who are actually living in this remote and like you say, this mountainous region? Many have said that, you know, this is a region which is still suffering from what happened in the 1990s, that you have millions of displaced people or refugees And also, the reports that are coming out are mainly from official sources. So there's a sense by some that the story and the conflict is being reported through entirely official channels, and there's no real sense of actually what is really going on there.
I think that's true, but I think it's only partly true, because we've seen in some of the casualty figures, they're talking about not forces on either side, of on Armenian or Azerbaijani side, but people who are from Nagorno-Karabakh, as they would see it, defending their territory. And there have been casualties there. We're talking in double figures, dozens, not yet hundreds, but the population there is very small. But one of the big grievances that's left over for Azerbaijan is that the population there is almost entirely Armenian. And Azerbaijan looks back to time in the Soviet era when, of course, peace was practically enforced. You couldn't imagine an enclave like this sort of declaring self-government or autonomy. But what happened in the late 80s was that as the Soviet Union was falling to pieces, Armenia basically took power in Nagorno-Karabakh. And the result was a displacement of large numbers of Azerbaijanis. They talk about ethnic cleansing. And the fact that Nagorno-Karabakh now is almost entirely Armenian is a result of what happened in those years. Before then, the population was quite mixed. And so that's a grievance that Azerbaijan has until now. And of course, they had to accommodate a lot of the people displaced, the refugees displaced from Nagorno-Karabakh. But, you know, then as now, it was a conflict that really wasn't seen with Nagorno-Karabakh, the actual territory at its center. It was seen as a contest between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which of course are very, very different now independent countries. Armenia is Christian with a big diaspora, which is quite vocal and has a lot of support from its host countries, the United States and France primarily, and Azerbaijan, which is a Muslim country, which grew rich very quick after independence from its oil revenue, but which now, because of declining oil prices, is encountering problems.
Mary Dajewski, thank you for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. Next, we turn our attention to the United States, where Donald Trump and Joe Biden will tonight go head-to-head in the first presidential debate on television. It comes amidst a partisan fight over the president's desire to rush through the nomination of a new Supreme Court justice and an explosive report about his tax returns or lack thereof. Well, our US elections correspondent Tomos Lewis has more.
Well, it's hard to remember a first presidential debate taking place under stakes that are appear to be so high. It's almost inevitable that Donald Trump will face a quite substantial number of questions, I'd say, on the revelations by the New York Times into his tax returns, which the newspaper published on Sunday. It's unclear the kind of strategy that Donald Trump will take to try and bat those questions away. The moderator is Chris Wallace, and he's been known to be fairly insistent with the president during interviews with him for Fox News over the years, and he is known for being fair in terms of his questions for both sides of the aisle. I'd say it's going to be incredibly consequential for Joe Biden. If you think back to the start of the Democratic primary process, he really struggled to deliver a performance that was consistently strong. And really, it was those debate performances that shook much confidence in the viability of his campaign. That, of course, all changed in the South Carolina primary. But I do think that if Joe Biden makes a misstep, this evening or in the debates to follow. That could really be an easy way in for the Donald Trump campaign to try and start spinning a narrative, having a narrative that sticks, that they haven't really managed to do towards Joe Biden so far, and to try and chip away at this still pretty substantial lead in both the national opinion polls, but also in some of the opinion polls in some of the key swing states as well. So it really will be an incredibly important night for both candidates tonight in Cleveland, Ohio.
Tomas Lewis, our US elections correspondent. You're listening to The Globalist. The time is 8:14 in Brussels, 7:14 here in London, and you're with The Globalist with me, Emma Nelson. The United Kingdom has refused to remove parts of a domestic parliamentary bill which overrides elements of the Brexit deal. This is despite the EU explicitly asking for it to do so. It's been seen as an opening salvo before the final official round of talks aimed at striking a deal before the end of the year. Well, Vincent McAvinney is a UK politics commentator and a regular voice here on Monocle 24. Good morning, Vinny.
Good morning.
That opening salvo I mentioned, it's the UK's refusal to remove parts of a domestic parliamentary bill which overrides elements of the Brexit deal. Explain to us why this is not the best way to start talks which are aimed at coming to an agreement.
Well, it's highly contentious and highly unprecedented, really. An agreement that's not even a year old, that Boris Johnson fought an election on, saying was an oven-ready deal, was singing its praises from the rafters, and is international law now fully approved. The UK trying to renege on parts of it, and this has caused widespread outcry, both domestically here in the UK and around the world. Here in the UK, there have been resignations of ministers and government lawyers. There has been outcry from the legal establishment here. There has been outcry as well from international partners, including most strongly from the United States, Nancy Pelosi putting in a strongly worded performance saying that if it in any way breached the Good Friday Agreement or the Belfast Agreement, as it's known, then there would be no US-UK trade deal. So it was a huge gambit. But just to check something that you said there in the question, it, you know, we say it's the end of the year, but in fact, the deadline to get this all sorted so it can all be ratified for the end of the year is indeed the 15th of October. So Michael Gove in Brussels saying that they'll use every second, every minute, every hour to reach agreement. Well, really, this is another attempt to really drive down the clock on Brussels to try and get a deal at the last minute possible.
Now, we heard yesterday from the European Commission's Maros Sefcovic, who said that the UK's negotiating position is still far apart from what the EU can accept. You've just mentioned there that we have a bit of a clock on. What is likely to be happening in the next couple of days? I mean, when you have this amount of pressure, is this what many people expected?
Well, I think you have to look at the setting both in Brussels and more widely. So, you know, there are reports that around 90% of the agreement, the future trade agreement, is done. But the remaining 10% is the most contentious. You always save that until the last. So that is things like the fisheries and the equal playing field. So when it comes to the state aid rules, which is where part of the withdrawal agreement is coming unstuck because of the way that Boris Johnson's administration wants to operate state aid, particularly their fascination with developing, you know, trillion-dollar tech companies and really making sure that the UK is a pioneer when it comes to tech and the green economy. And so those are the real sticking points there. But stepping away outside of the negotiation room, you have to look at the wider context. Things have changed in the past couple of months for Boris Johnson. He's had an incredibly tumultuous first year of his prime ministership. He is still, it seems, weakened from his bout of coronavirus. For the first time over the weekend, the Labour Party pulled ahead in domestic polling. And so with the real rise that we've got here now in the number of cases of coronavirus, the sort of localized lockdowns and all the rules around the country, by the time it gets to the end of the year, how badly that could be going, it seems that the UK government seems to be backing away from the idea of no deal, the harshest of all Brexits, because they realize that coupled with an incredibly bad winter of coronavirus might just be too much for this government.
You say that, but we have at the helm of all this Michael Gove, the Minister for the Cabinet Office, who many say has been sort of arguably a rather influential in the way that the show has been run for the last few months. And this is possibly his chance to sort of fulfil what he still believes is Britain's desire to get out of the EU without a deal.
Yeah, that's right. I think if you look at the roles that are being played, Michael Gove has very much been delegated by Boris Johnson to head this up. Boris Johnson is a master delegator. We're seeing so much of that with his domestic policy and Dominic Cummings. And really, it's because in some ways you look at the situation, you thought, you know, Michael Gove going long back has always been a Eurosceptic, was a real true believer in Brexit. And he is seen as the one, particularly when you read David Cameron's accounts of what happened, that really brought Boris Johnson into the Brexit fold. Boris Johnson, of course, had been a Brussels correspondent, wrote a lot of mocking columns about Brussels, wasn't a fan of how it operated, but it's seen that, you know, when it comes to who is a true believer in it, for Boris Johnson, it was an opportunity to perhaps grab power. But for Michael Gove, this is something that he's worked decades to try to achieve.
One thing that the European Union has said is that it will be quite key, well, not be shy, I think, is the word that we used, in considering all the legal options available if the United Kingdom decides to break international law. How realistic a prospect is that?
Well, it would be incredibly contentious, and it also might backfire for them if it ends up in the European courts. You know, that could be seized upon by the Brexiteers here in the UK, by the Conservative Party, as being a reason that it needs to go for no deal, that it needs to break through. A lot of their arguments centre around, you know, British laws that are developed in the British Parliament, parliamentary sovereignty, but also British courts enforcing those laws, not having EU jurisdiction supersede British legal precedent. So it is a risky manoeuvre for them. And it's something that, you know, the UK also probably doesn't want to go, as it's trying to extend its hand around the world, it probably doesn't want to get caught up in a big legal fight with the body at the end of all of this that is still going to be its largest trading partner.
And tell us, finally, the Irish Premier, Micheál Martin, has said he's not optimistic that the government will be able to strike a post-Brexit deal. And he said his own government is now preparing for the terrible reality of a no-deal scenario at the end of 2020. People are now getting their into position, aren't they, to accept that there may well be no deal. And this, in particular for Ireland and Northern Ireland, could be incredibly damaging.
Incredibly damaging. We know that the Irish economy is very dependent on its relationship with the United Kingdom for things like exports of farming products. And so the impact when you go to Ireland at the moment, you know, there is as much discussion at some times of Brexit in Ireland as there is in the United Kingdom because those economies are so aligned. But stepping back from the economics of it, if we go to no deal, where we go on to WTO terms, or what the government likes to pretend to call an Australian deal, but it is in fact no deal, then really, then 2021 is all about the UK constitutional settlement. Will the United Kingdom remain the United Kingdom? Because we've got, you know, in Ireland, the rising support in Northern Ireland for perhaps having a border poll to see whether or not there could be reunification of the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. If those in Northern Ireland feel that they're going to suffer economically by leaving the EU, you know, there are even some unionists, when you look at the polling, who now possibly support reunification because economically it'll make more sense. And then also, of course, Scotland, there are local elections there for the Scottish Assembly at Holyrood in the spring of next year, which the SNP, the Scottish National Party, are looking to sort of have as the trigger to perhaps a second referendum. They think if they get enough support in that, that they could have a second referendum. And part of that is all about the European Union, because in the last referendum, the EU was strong-armed by David Cameron into saying, well, Scotland, if you leave the United Kingdom, you also leave the EU and you have to apply again. So if enough people in Scotland are worried about having left the EU without a deal, then maybe more minded to vote to go for independence, but also then to rejoin the EU as a new independent nation.
Vincent McAvinney, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's programme.
It's a day that we all remember, kind of the 9/11 moment, if you will, where you ask your friends, where were you when it happened?
We'll be covering the sinking of the MS Estonia, sailing from Tallinn to Stockholm 26 years ago. And when it sank, more than 850 people lost their lives. This is all to come on The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It was the world's second worst civilian maritime disaster after the sinking of the Titanic and something that shook the countries around the Baltic Sea. MS Estonia was sailing from Tallinn to Stockholm 26 years ago on the 28th of September 1994 when it sank in a storm and more than 850 people lost their lives. An official investigation concluded that the ferry's bow shield had failed, damaging the bow ramp and flooding the car deck. But now the foreign ministers of Estonia, Finland and Sweden have jointly announced they'll look into new evidence provided by a documentary, as new images from the wreck show a big hole on the starboard side of what's left of the ferry, something that, until now, has never been documented. To find out more, Monocle's Marcus Hippie spoke to Petri Bertsov, our correspondent in Helsinki.
So a Swedish documentary film that was recently released contained some never-before-seen footage of the Estonia's wreck. The footage, for example, showed that there is a large 4-meter hole on the side of the ship's hull in the bottom of the Baltic Sea. Now, experts believe that something must have hit the ship to cause such massive damage. And this is, of course, significant because there are a number of conspiracy theories about the ship sinking, and they've claimed that it sank as a result of an explosion. But this far, all the investigators have not found any sign of that, of course, until today. Now, the reason for this is that in recent years, the wreck has moved and turned around, now revealing this large hole for the first time.
And obviously, Petri, we have to mention that this boat sank in 1994, and obviously there was a lot of research, a lot of reports trying to find out what exactly happened, and the conclusion has been that a stormy weather caused water to pour through an open bow door and into the Estonia's car deck. But basically, it looks like this documentary suggests that the reason could have been something else.
Yeah, that's correct, Marcus. So the documentary, first of all, it's a really extensive look at the accident. It consists of 5 episodes, each of them 45 minutes long, the final episode over an hour long. They look at a lot of the details, but they were particularly interested in how the ship sank. Now, let's remember that it took less than an hour for this 150-meter long, 16,000-ton ship to sink to the bottom of the Baltic Sea. I think a ship of this size has never before sunk this fast without some kind of wartime damage, such as an explosion hitting it. Now, this discovery of a large hole in the hull would partly explain why it sank so fast, but this, of course, makes it very interesting, and people start asking, you know, what caused this hole?
What has the reaction been so far if you look at what the press has been saying, for example, in Estonia, Finland and Sweden?
It's the number one news story in all of those three countries. It's still the sinking of Estonia is still somewhat shrouded in mystery in all of these three countries. As you said, after the accident, an extensive 3-year investigation was launched. It was concluded in 1997 by Finland, Sweden and Estonia, and their finding was basically that the ship sank as a result of the front visor having been damaged due to the rough weather, and that caused water to start flooding the vehicle deck. However, there are many unanswered questions. We know, for instance, that Estonia had previously been used to transport explosives. We also know that the shipping company had run-ins with the Russian mafia. And we also have several passenger accounts that detail strong noises prior to the sinking, noises that sounded like explosions. So, you know, people are intrigued by these stories, and this new documentary will undoubtedly add fuel to the fire when it comes to these conspiracy theories.
So what is happening next?
Next, the foreign ministers of Finland, Estonia and Sweden, they announced they will reopen the investigation on what led the passenger ferry to sink in 1994. The authorities said that they will carry out this new investigation in as transparent a manner as they can and release their findings in due course.
Petri, obviously, you know, we both are Finnish and we both probably remember that day in 1994 when Estonia sank. Could you try to paint a picture of how deeply the sinking of Estonia shook all the countries around the Baltic Sea?
It's a day, as you said, a day that we all remember, kind of the 9/11 moment, if you will, where you ask your friends, where were you when it happened? It's the deadliest peacetime shipwreck in European waters ever. And let's not forget that it happened in a time of great geopolitical transformation also around the Baltic Sea, falling apart of the Soviet Union, Estonia and the other Baltic countries gaining independence, Finland and Sweden joining the European Union. So I think the conspiracy theories are also somewhat a result of those turbulent times. But also, as you said, due to the sheer scale of the accident, you know, 852 people, Finns, Estonians and Swedes died, and that means a lot of us lost friends and relatives in the accident.
And as you mentioned, there's been a number of conspiracy theories over the course of the last 26 years or so. Do you think we will one day see the day when there's some kind of an agreement of what actually happened and if we can actually see an end to all these conspiracy theories and we can kind of let Estonia rest in peace?
Well, that really depends on what they find out in this new investigation. There are still just so many unanswered questions. If they can somehow exhaustively answer all of those questions, then I think people might be willing to put this to rest.
That was Petri Bertsov, Monocle's Helsinki correspondent there in conversation with Marcus Hippie. The time is 7:30 here in London. Time on The Globalist for a quick summary of some of the world news headlines. The number of people who've died with the coronavirus has passed 1 million worldwide. Deaths in the US, Brazil and India make up almost half the total. The figures from Johns Hopkins University have been described as mind-numbing by the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The Speaker of the House of Representatives in the US, Nancy Pelosi, says Donald Trump's alleged tax avoidance is a matter of national security. Ms. Pelosi said she wanted to know whether the president owed money to foreign interests. It follows the publication of his tax records after an investigation by the New York Times. And the mayor of a village in Romania has been re-elected to office despite dying 4 weeks ago. Ion Aliman won a landslide victory of 64% of the vote in Devezelu in the south of the country. Officials say it was too late to reprint the ballot papers to remove the name of Mr. Aliman, who died from coronavirus complications. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Let's continue with a look at today's newspapers. Joining me is Monocle's contributing editor, Andrew Muller. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
What's caught your eye?
Looking at the Australian newspapers as usual, starting with The Age, and its big story is that the curfew in Melbourne, obviously part of the COVID-19 measures, has been lifted. So 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew has been lifted. I kind of think that in the sort of the global context, we've forgotten how mad it is that an entire city of Melbourne stature has basically been told to go to bed at 9 p.m. every night now for weeks.
Well, it's unusual. That's assuming that everybody goes to bed as soon as they get home. But there are other things that people can do in the evenings. But there is that feeling, though, isn't there, that the sort of the curtailing of an entire society is quite significant.
It is. The story is interesting because they've basically surveyed just a few of their readers who are making the point that it's not like life has returned to anything like normal. You still can't travel further than 5 kilometres from your house and you can't visit any of your friends. But there was a quote from one who says, like, you know, part of me felt like I was a small child being told I had to be in bed for a certain time of night. And one reader said that with the curfew over, they now intended to go for a walk at 11 p.m. with their entire household and then go to Macca's for a coffee on their way back home, which on the one hand is funny, but on the other hand is kind of a reminder of just how much basic everyday take it for granted for life has been lost everywhere, really. But Melbourne does appear to be an especially hyper example of it.
There was this balance that every politician had to strike every time a lockdown was imposed, about how long actually the psychology of a nation could put up with it. Is there a sense that, you know, if you have been told to go home by 9 o'clock, that now is about the time for people to be let back out again?
Yeah, I think so. By and large, Melbourne's public, I think, have held the line pretty well and have maintained faith to a large extent in the state government, in particular Premier Dan Andrews. There's been a few noisy cranks having demonstrations saying they think this is all part of some ghastly plot to enslave them by injecting 5G chips into their bloodstream and so on. But there hasn't really been all that much of that kind of thing. It has been a fairly admirable act of municipal solidarity in most respects, I think.
They might have trouble trying to ask everybody to do it again, trying to get them out of Macca's after they've gone for their 11-kilometre walk. let's move on to the ABC. I mean, it's always the case that the biggest stories are told with the smallest examples, and micro reflects macro. But ABC, you've noticed, have been particularly good at this kind of thing.
They've been really, really good about this. This is the ABC, Australia's national broadcaster. This is their website. And they've just been doing stories following up on, almost as if they're just picking people or industries at random and then going out to find out what this has been like for them. And it is a truism of journalism anywhere that you can learn a great deal by just asking people how business is. This one focuses in particular on their families, and they're usually family businesses, who take rides and other amusements to Australia's great agricultural shows. So they're focusing particularly on the Elwyn Bell business, Bell's Amusement, which, as it says, has been towing its thrill rides and caravans around the country for 96 years. They go to 50 shows a year, and obviously their entire year has been cancelled. They live on a property near Queanbeyan, which is up on the border between New South Wales and the Australian Capital Territory. And there's kind of a heartwarming glimmer here in that they've gone ahead and put on their own small-scale carnival at the showground in Queanbeyan. They can get 500 people a time in there, so it's something. And there's a quote from the current family patriarch, Elwyn Bell, just saying he just wanted to bring a bit more fun to the community, and he drops the lovely colloquial Australianism, put some smiles on their dials.
One of the things that is the case of this family, clearly being pretty resilient and having another go and thinking of something else to do, but they fall through the kind of the cracks that appear when governments try to help people, insofar as agricultural shows themselves have been getting grants, but the people who actually do the showmen, do the bumper cars and the great rides, they're the ones who actually missed out.
Yeah, I think that's been the case with governments all over the world, though, is that there's only so much money and there's only so many places policies like that can go, and people do always get forgotten. And again, going back to the recurring thing the ABC has been doing, they've been very good at picking up on those people that have been forgotten about. But it's a lovely piece of reporting. It tells the story very well. It finds some glimmer of positivity in it, and it is a demonstration, as you say, of that resilience that people are having to demonstrate.
Speaking of resilience, where are we going, Andrew, with the Batmobile?
I love this story. This is an Australian football story. Last weekend should have been grand final day in Melbourne, and this is a lovely revisiting in the age of a particular piece of Australian football mythology. The Australian Football League keeps trying to do pre-show and halftime entertainments at the grand final, which is kind of like our equivalent of the Super Bowl, and I think they want to do something of that stature, but it never works, and it's almost always awful. And one of the most legendary ones was the launch of the 1991 grand final, which was inexplicably fanfared by Angry Anderson, the singer from Rose Tattoo.
Isn't everything?
Being driven onto the ground in an imitation blue Batmobile in the company of Australian marathon runner Rob DiCostella, and singing one of his songs like it had done something to upset him. But this story tracks down the actual blue Batmobile and notes that 32 fans have come together to actually buy the thing. They have spent $25,300 on it. That is a steal, actually. That's only about 12 grand split 32 ways. But yeah, they found it. And it's a lovely story. There's just, as one of them says, he's been thinking about this for nearly 30 years. And he says, I was at the 1991 grand final. I sat there in horror, having to listen to Angry Anderson and laughing my ass off as this blue thing rolled out onto Waverley. He had a videotape of it that he treasured for years, took it to London with him, and now he owns the vehicle. It pains me to say it, because these are Hawthorn fans we're talking about. And as a Geelong supporter myself, these people are my you know, just my worst enemy. But this is a heartwarming story, and good luck to them.
Yes. I mean, how much interest was there for the Batmobile, apart from this one individual who treasured the tape? I mean, there's lots of questions here, Andrew, that we don't have time to answer. But one of them is why?
I think because it's there. And when you ask how much interest there is, given that it went for $25,000, I'm going to go ahead and guess not much.
Andrew Muller, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
We have the business news in just a few moments' time, but first, not one but four of the world's major art galleries has decided to postpone an exhibition of the work of the American artist Philip Guston. Guston made his name first as an abstract artist, but then went on to depict images of hooded Ku Klux Klan members, often smoking or painting their own self-portrait. He called it a portrayal of the banality of evil. But the four galleries, the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., Tate Modern here in London, and the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, and the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, say the exhibition needs to be postponed, and I quote, until a time at which we think that the powerful message of social and racial justice that is at the centre of Philip Guston's work can be more clearly interpreted. Well, Ben Luke is reviews editor at the Art Newspapers and is host of the Art Newspapers podcasts. Welcome, Ben.
Hello.
Just explain to us the importance of Philip Guston before all this enormous argument blew up.
He's one of the great painters of the second half of the 20th century. And an estimation of his importance is that I can't think of another artist that is more often mentioned to me today by painters working now. So he is hugely influential, and he made some of the most indelibly fantastic images of the latter half of the 20th century. And most importantly, he made some of the most politically engaged paintings of the 20th century too.
Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, he began, even in his teenage years, he was making portraits of Klansmen in anti-fascist paintings. You know, he made murals when he was 17 years old, which was an anti-fascist mural. He depicted Klansmen, he depicted lynchings, and it was always from an anti-fascist standpoint. And then, as you say, he became an abstract painter. So he left figuration, went into an abstract period for a good more than a decade. And then when he returned to figuration, the Klansman reappeared. And again, there was this extraordinary invective, but also a sense of looking at himself. One of the great things about Guston is that he was conscious of white supremacy. He was conscious of his own complicity in white supremacy. And that's what makes this decision so baffling.
Yes, it's a big problem that many have said that, look, we have an enormous retrospective that's going around the world, and yet the delay is seems a very strange timing, given the fact that this is an artist who chose to show life's injustices. And some have said, I hate this expression, but he is more woke than anybody else.
Well, I mean, in the catalogue, which is really important actually about this, is that the galleries did try to recontextualise Guston for the 21st century. The exhibition is called Philip Guston Now, and in the catalogue there are texts by artists, several artists. Two of them are African-American artists, and both of them engage with the Klan imagery. They are attempting to contextualise it within the 21st century. And in the text by Glenn Ligon, one of the leading artists in the world today, he says that Guston is woke. He quotes Guston's quote about how Guston attempted to, not to illustrate the KKK, but to imagine what it was like to be evil, to imagine to walk in their shoes. And that's what's so baffling about this idea of you know, sort of being able to more clearly interpret Guston's work in 4 years' time. You know, what does that mean? It just seems so odd when it's clear that these museums, the curators of this exhibition, had gone out of their way to try to present Guston for the 21st century. So, you know, that is one of the more confusing aspects of this statement. And I think a lot of people are wondering if there are, in fact, other motivations for postponing the show.
What might they be?
Well, we don't know what the financial implications are. 4 years seems an extraordinarily arbitrary length of time. We don't know if there are potential funders for the exhibition who have withdrawn their money. There's too many questions about this, because it seems to me that the responsibility that the curators took in order to try to present a very modern image of Guston was absolutely right. And it also, isn't it insulting to people like Glenn Ligon and Trenton Doyle Hancock, another African-American artist who had absolutely reinterpreted Guston, to now say, well, we need 4 years to find other alternative voices to present Guston? I think it's profoundly a profoundly troubling decision.
It takes a long time to pull together an exhibition like this and to organise it and take it around the world. Events of the last 6 months, the Black Lives Matter protests and the focus on racial injustice has become so keenly felt that I wonder whether the question is being asked to not necessarily take away and recalibrate the exhibition, but to add to it.
Well, this is it. They in the statement, they say that we plan to rebuild the retrospective with time to reconsider the many important issues the work raises. And, you know, that's a laudable idea if they hadn't already done it. You know, in the catalogue, again, the curators state that the world is suddenly the subject of very clear racial injustices and social injustices, and Guston, therefore, is a very pertinent artist for now. So it seems to me that they've done the work that they say they need to do in this statement already to a degree. Of course, the events of recent months and the Black Lives Matter protests of recent months have made this even clearer. But you have to remember that Black Lives Matter was founded in 2013. We've had a white supremacist president in the United States, and that has been widely debated over many years and talked about. And absolutely, when the organizers were putting this show together over the last 5 years, those thoughts would have been uppermost in their thinking about the show. So, and also another thing I think is it would be actually quite easy for these museums to call on their very talented educators, the artist community around them, to contextualize the work even more, to bring in public events, even if it's on Zoom, you know, to have events, talks, seminars, which really clearly interpret Guston's work for now. But it must be stressed, he's a good guy. You know, there are plenty of morally dubious artists out there, but Guston isn't. You know, he right from the start was an anti-fascist artist, and he made a series of images which it seems to me are utterly directly critical of the Klan and white supremacy. And it seems to me so bizarre that we should choose this moment to not present him to audiences now and to show how committed to anti-fascism he was all his life.
Ben Luke from the Art Newspaper, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24.
Keen for a quick tutorial on where you should take your business over the coming months? Interested to learn how one of the world's biggest pharma companies responded to the pandemic? Curious about the future of air travel? Or wondering whether shops will still matter? Join me, Tyler Brulé, weekly when I sit down with the chiefs. From CEOs to editors-in-chief, CMOs to chief strategy officers, our series is a fast-paced, intimate discussion with chiefs, big and small, from around the world. That's The Chiefs, right here on Monocle 24, or wherever you find finer podcasts.
You are The Globalist, and it's time to talk business now with a financial analyst and regular voice on Monocle 24, Louise Cooper. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning, Emma.
We have despairing news coming out of the World Bank.
Yes, this is not the most positive discussion we've ever had this morning, Emma. I apologise for the sadness of the news. So this is the World Bank, its latest report on East Asia. And it is pointing out that the COVID crisis has led to 38 million people being in poverty, 33 million who would normally, thanks to economic growth, have sort of taken themselves out of poverty, another 5 million who weren't in poverty going into poverty. So just in one area, East Asia Pacific, you've got 38 million people in poverty: Myanmar, Indonesia, Cambodia, Mongolia, Laos and Vietnam. This used to be a fast growing economically, you know, relatively, you know, pulling itself out into poverty, many years, many decades of work being undone. And also the important thing is it's not just like this is not going to be 1 year, because you've got school closures, which can be devastating for children trying to get out of poverty and trying to do better in life. And so there's a whole load of worries about sickness, food insecurity, job losses, school closures, and the impact of all this can last a lifetime.
There are three elements to it, aren't there, according to the Financial Times: COVID-19, lockdown and the global recession, each thing seeking to effectively stop progress in any form.
And it's not, of course, just East Asia. So today we've got another warning. This is from the United Nations World Food Programme. They're warning about Latin America. But it's the same in all these developing countries. You know, if people lose their jobs, if they fall into poverty, guess what? They can't afford to eat. So the United Nations World Food Programme says in Latin America, there are about 4 million people pre the pandemic who couldn't afford to eat. Now that is set to rise to 16 million just in the few months to come. I mean, Guatemala, the government of Guatemala has already said we've got significant increase in the rate of acute malnutrition among children aged 5 and under. You know, we look at these numbers, we look at these millions, we talk about poverty, but the reality of that is that there are children starving.
The Institute for Fiscal Studies say that the way that governments are going to pull themselves out of this will inevitably have to involve tax hikes, which no one is going to want, is it?
So we know governments around the world are spending huge amounts of money to avoid economic catastrophe as a result of COVID restrictions. I mean, just vast sums of money, Emma. You know, makes the global financial crisis look like a walk in the park. Completely. And this level of state involvement in our life, I mean, God, they tell you who you can have sex with now here in the UK. So the level of state involvement, the level of taxation, the level of control, the level of state support isn't just going to be here for a few years. It's going to be here for many decades to come. And the point about taxes is it ain't going to be me that pays for the taxes. I'm 50. I'm 10, 15 years away from retirement. It's the next generation. It's the young adults that are going to be paying this back for decades and decades to come. And yet it's the next generation, the young people that have been hardest hit by the crisis. They've lost education. They're most likely to work in areas where the jobs have disappeared. And yet they don't die from COVID. They're making sacrifices for an older generation that one could well say have had it a lot easier than they have. And in fact, this is highlighted in a report today from Prince Charles's Prince's Trust that's looked at a whole bunch of young people across the UK from 16 to 25, and they are feeling pretty hopeless about their futures.
Louise Cooper, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. After that, let us try to end on something a little more hopeful and head to Italy to do so. The city of Milan, and indeed the design world, was floored by the cancellation of Salone del Mobile in April as a result of COVID. But almost 6 months on, a little normality is trying to return. Milan is playing host to City Design Milano, 2 weeks when designers and journalists can get together in person for a series of events. Well, one of those journalists is Monocle's very own Nick Moniz, who's there. Very warm welcome back. Hello, Nick.
Good morning, Emma. How are you?
What's very well, thank you. And there must be a great feeling that people are indeed back.
Yeah, I mean, it's phenomenal. The city, I mean, obviously quite a lot quieter than most design weeks and Salone del Mobile. But I mean, there's still people out and about. I've seen some tourists here coming over to get their design fixed, carrying their big cameras around to take a look at what's happening. And yeah, I mean, the city, I guess, just feels alive.
There's been enormous amount of praise for the way that Milan has basically got its act together and has, it's not Salone, nothing can be Salone, but at least it is a start to try to rebuild this kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, I mean, this is the event itself is curated by the city, which I guess shows, you know, their recognition of the importance of such an event. And Fiore Salone, who also run events in tandem with Salone in April. And I guess it's given these furniture companies, you know, that rely on being able to share their work, you know, for a big part of their commercial livelihood. You know, these sorts of events are a chance for them to share their latest wares and their new releases and plenty of times even custom works made specifically for Salone with architects and designers who are going to use them. So having this come back is just huge. Or, I mean, rather than come back, this is a brand new event, but having this here is enormous.
Tell us a little bit about what the highlights have been, because obviously there must be great excitement, but, you know, what are people really going for?
Yeah, I mean, I've just sort of been poking my head into a number of different sort of spaces. I went to Older, which is a design studio who are usually responsible for making beautiful uniforms. They're actually quite good friends of Monocle. They kit out our cafe staff, if you've seen that. And I went and saw a collaboration they did with the designer Alexander Vinther. And rather than uniforms, this was more of a passion project. So there were carafes and chairs and sculptures and cutlery. And I mean, just to again reiterate the importance of this event, this was their first opportunity to actually show their work. You know, they'd planned to show in April, but this has given them the space to show their work and hopefully expand their commercial opportunities. But I mean, there's a host of, you know, all the big names, Boffi, Cassina, Minotti, all showing their wares and sharing it with the people.
I wonder how much the aftermath of COVID has actually shaped the way that people are designing, what people are focusing on making, and what people now believe is an important thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's maybe not changed what people are designing, but maybe it's given us a new appreciation of the importance of certain things and certain spaces. Certainly the home has obviously become far, far more important. You know, and I went to De More Gallery, who, I mean, it was like out of, you know, Home Beautiful or something like that, or Monocle magazine, if you will. Going in and seeing these beautiful, I guess, almost movie-like sets and home spaces and the sort of space where maybe you'd be comfortable, God forbid, spending extended periods of time in it. And I think that for me, is what this has been about. It's maybe not changed what people are designing, but it's certainly given me a new appreciation for what is important.
And the sense is that Design City Milano will what continue next year if you know, if Salone comes back, when Salone comes back, I should say. You know, will there be space for this smaller offshoot?
I mean, there's not been an announcement, but I think, you know, we were deprived all of this year. I can't see why we couldn't have another event running next year. And I mean, it's lovely, obviously, it came off the back of Milan Design Week last week. So, you know, if you held it at this time in September, again, you've got that nice sort of relationship with all these designers, you know, whether in fashion or furniture and interiors coming together at the same time in Milan.
Thank you very much, as ever. Nick Manise, enjoy your time in Milan. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers, Daniel Bate, Augustine Macellari and Marcus Hippie, and our researcher, Charlie Phil McCourt, and our studio manager, Steph Chungu, with editing assistance from Miles Blumsom. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The briefing is live at midday in London. You heard Andrew Muller doing the newspaper review. He'll be back behind the microphone for the briefing at midday. And The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that, if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.
Da Londra state ascoltando Monocle 24.
Je luistert naar Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Broadcasting from London, Zurich, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Toronto and Los Angeles. You're listening to Monocle 24. With our daily digital bulletins, films, books, newspapers, magazines and radio service, we're your complete media partner, around the clock, around the world. Stay with us. More great programming is up next. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It's 1600 in Seoul, 9 a.m. in Zurich, 8 a.m. here at Midori House in London, and 3 a.m. in New York City. You're listening to Monocle 24.